Thank you, Ted. It's really lovely to be back here. And Ted told me as I walked in that this is 14 years ago, back at the old place, the Masonic place. And today I'm here to tell you about my latest book, which is published on June 2nd. Think about that. It's not published until June 2nd, so you were getting advance copies today. You are among the first. I spoke last night at the Arts and Letters Club in Toronto, and you are the second people that I'm going to be addressing about this book. And so I'm really happy to be here, and thank you for the invitation. To begin, I'd like you to maybe have to do a little bit of arithmetic. What were you doing at age 24? 24. What had you accomplished in life at age 24? I know if I look back at age 24, I hadn't done a whole lot. Many things I wouldn't be proud of, but those were the university days that I just don't want to talk about anymore, especially with my wife. And age 24, let's talk about Sanford Fleming and what he had done until age 24. Let's just start with that. So he was born in a little town called Kirkcaldy in Scotland, and it was right across the Firth of Forth from Edinburgh. And he quit school at what the equivalent of about grade 9, our grade 9. And he went to work. He was fascinated by trains, and so he wanted to find out more about trains and how you could work in the railroad business. And so he found a job with this guy named Sang, who was a surveyor, who was surveying a new track that was being laid across Scotland. But he was a kid, and so therefore he wasn't going to get the kind of job he wanted. But he did learn about surveying. He learned how to do surveying. He learned how to use a compass. He learned how to measure. He learned how to sketch. He learned how to use the sextant, the old small instrument that you look at the star and you look at the horizon. You can see where you are on the earth. He learned a great deal. By the time he was 18 years old, he was restless. And he and his older brother, David, who was working in Dad's carpentry shop, he was a furniture maker, decided that what they would do is they would take the advantage of going to Canada, which was the land of hope and promise, that every young man could fulfill his dreams in Canada. And what they would do is they'd go to Canada for a little while and then write back to see if the family could maybe come over and seek the opportunities that are in the new colony. So up to Liverpool with his older brother and on a three-masted schooner across the North Atlantic. Three times they almost capsized, then the ship almost went down in three different gales. Him and his brother, his older brother David, like all of the other passengers, were responsible for bringing all the food that they were going to eat on the seven-week journey, cooking the food, keeping the fire going so they could continue to cook the food for them and the others that were all around, doing their own laundry, and cleaning up not only their area but the entire ship. So it was not a Titanic-like ship, that it didn't go down, but it was also not glorious at all. They finally made it to Canada, and he went up, and where he ended up was in Peterborough. Peterborough because Dad's cousin was the doctor in Peterborough, the only doctor in Peterborough, a guy named John Hutchison. And he had been practicing medicine in Peterborough and had said, I think I'm going to leave now and go to Toronto where I can make more money. And the people of Peterborough built him a house. I don't know if you've ever seen the Hutchison House in Peterborough, but that's why that stone house is there, because the people of Peterborough didn't want to lose their one and only doctor. Thank God we don't have to worry about doctor shortages now. So what happened is he and David arrived, and Hutchison put him up in a very tiny room. You can go and visit it still, and it's a very small room, about the size of three of these tables put together, and that's where he was staying. Now, David, in no time, found work as a furniture maker, and then he moved to Toronto, and he was doing quite well. Fleming, though, couldn't find work as a surveyor anywhere. Despite the fact that the colony was growing, there was no work to be had for a guy who had no papers. He had no certification. He just had what many people, and I read this in his diaries, said, oh, you're not a surveyor. You have an interest in surveying. And so he couldn't find work. So what he did is he traveled to Toronto. He traveled. He was in Lindsay. He was in Port Hope and Cobourg. He went all over the place looking for work, couldn't find it. And so he's back in Peterborough, despondent, working in a general store from the guy who crossed the street who owned a general store. He's working there. And then he finally said, I used to be really good at drawing things. So maybe, and he drew some sketches of buildings in Peterborough. And that what he found is that people were interested in buying them. So he went to Toronto and he started sketching St. James Cathedral and other sketchy city places and buildings. And he was actually selling them. He went to a place where you can get copies made, and it wasn't like a Xerox machine in those days. You had to, a lithograph, which means you have to get stone and carve and together. It's a really long and expensive and arduous process. And he made copies of his sketches. And he thought, okay, rather than finding work, I'm going to create my own work. Not only was he going to do sketches, he was back home in Peterborough, and he said there has never been a map of Peterborough drawn, despite the fact that the town is growing. And so he, on his own, borrowed some surveying equipment from a guy named Birdsall, the guy who started Aspidal Township, just east of Peterborough, and he drew a map of Peterborough, the first map ever, very detailed and exact, because he knew how to do surveying. And he sketched around the map a number of the prominent buildings, mostly churches. And he took it to Toronto, to this shop, had it lithographed back to Peterborough, and he sold it for the equivalent now of $99 a copy. Now he's making some money. People in Cobourg heard, this guy's a really talented map maker. So they hired him to map, and then he made more money selling those maps. Now he said, I've got enough money now, I think I can go, and he moved to Toronto. And he got a job with the guy that was doing the lithographing. And the guy said, you know what, there is a map of Toronto, I wonder if you could work for me and do a lithograph of that. So, like I said, long, arduous process. He looked at the map, and over a couple of days went back to the guy and said, you know what, this is, not only is it inaccurate in what it shows, there's great gobs of the city that have grown since this map. I think we should start and do a whole new map. It took him over a year to do it. He surveyed all of Toronto up and down. Toronto was growing like a T along the lakeshore and up Yonge Street, and basically between Peter and Parliament, and that was it. North of Queen Street was farms or woods. He worked on that map, and while he was doing it, he looked at the Toronto Harbor as he was surveying it, and he said, you know, I don't think this is the most efficient use of this harbor, and I don't think this is the best place for it even. He hired a boat, and he went out and did soundings where he found the depth of the water here, there, and all over, and he said, you know, I think it would be better if it was here, and I think it would be better if it was configured like this. And he took it to the Toronto Harbor Commission, and the Toronto Harbor Commission said, that's brilliant. They took it to City Hall, and City Hall said, that's exactly what we should do. The Toronto Harbor, as it exists now, is where it is and like it is because Sandford Fleming said that's how it should be. When he decided that, he said, you know what? Front Street is almost where the lakeshore is. It would be better if we took a lot of the dirt that is being dug up because buildings are being built, and we took it and moved the shoreline out into the lake more. What we could then do is have a place where people could, on a Sunday afternoon or a nice evening, walk along the lakeshore, because I believe the lakeshore should belong to the people, not to rich people who can build houses along it. And he called that strip the Esplanade. And the city council said, again, great idea, and they built the Esplanade. He finally finished that map, and he presented it, and it was acknowledged as the best map there had ever been. In the book, there is on the open cover, you can take a look, and you can see the Toronto map that he created, and you can see a lot of the city that isn't there, but also the city that is there. It's a fascinating map. While he was doing that, he became well known for the mapping and for the work he was doing. He became really well known when they accepted his suggestions for the harbor. And so other places started hiring. He sketched out the city of Brampton, at that point the village of Brampton, and he said, this is where it should be, this is how the road should work, and this is where the growth should happen, and there needs to be a road from Toronto up. And he not only laid out, here's where the road should be, he was then put in charge of building the road. So he hired the people. He did the procurement to get all of the equipment and all of the stuff that you need to build the road. He was then hired by the city of Hamilton, and the city of Hamilton said, we have a problem with water supply. And so he said, what we're going to do is use the mountain. If you know anything about Hamilton, it's not the escarpment, it's the mountain in Hamilton. And we'll use the water that's coming down from the mountain, and that will be your water supply. Don't draw it from the lake, because it was already becoming polluted with some of the industries that were growing up around Burlington Bay. He then designed, back in Toronto, they asked him, the city council said, we want to expand out in the east as well. And what would be the best place to put a road out there so that we could expand out? And so he looked around and he said, okay, right about here, he designed it. And he said, that's where it should go. And then he was put in charge of building the Danforth. So what we had is all of this stuff was going on. He was a voracious reader. He read at clubs called mechanics institutes, that mechanics institutes were built for working class people so they could have a library they could go to and read. He read everything he could about mathematics and calculus and geometry and geography and cartography, and became self-taught in all of these areas to the point where he believed he could now get his surveying license. Figure all the work that he's done. Now he's going to get his license to do the work that he'd already done. He went to Montreal, and he arrived in Montreal and went to the Parliament buildings. The capital of Canada was at Montreal at that point. It was bouncing back and forth between Quebec City, Montreal, Kingston, and Toronto. And he went through the Parliament buildings. He was amazed by their library with all the beautiful volumes. And he went the next day and saw a crowd had formed. You see, the government had passed this thing called the Rebellion Losses Bill, in which a lot of people that had caused the 1837 rebellion were now getting compensated for their losses. A lot of the rich people in Montreal and Quebec didn't like that idea. So a lot of the rich people, the Tories, lawyers and people like that, started protesting against the government. They had a great big meeting where the audience turned into a crowd and the crowd turned into a mob, and they started pelting rocks at the Parliament buildings and actually set the Parliament buildings on fire. The Parliament buildings of Canada were now aflame. Fleming was there and saw the whole thing. He thought about the books that he saw, and what did he do? He ran into the building, into the building that was on fire. He ran to the library to try to save some of those books. But the heat and the smoke and the flames were too much. He was pushed back. He was, as he was trying to get out of the building now, because flames and smoke were all around him, he saw where the legislature sat, and he saw at the end, over the speaker's chair, over the speaker's throne, was a gigantic oil painting of Queen Victoria. I can't let that burn, he said. He ran to the front. He got it off the wall. He took it out of the frame, put it under his arm, and ran out the front door as the flames were rolling over his head. At that point, he gave it to the police, and that was later put in the Canadian Senate, and it sat in the Canadian Senate chamber, that picture of Queen Victoria that is there, saved by Fleming. He passed. He is now a full-fledged surveyor. When he got back to Toronto, he continued to do more work, and there was more. He formed a partnership now with another guy by the name Rideau, because there was just too much work to handle for him. And he was creating roads, then be the chief engineer to build the roads, and creating more towns, more communities all around Ontario. And at that point, he said, you know, there are too many engineers who only speak to engineers, scientists who only speak to scientists, and politicians who don't seem to speak to anybody in any positive way. I can say that because I are one. So what I think we need is some kind of organization where all of these silos can be knocked down and the people can talk to each other for the betterment of the entire community. And so he and another guy got together and they formed something called the Canadian Institute. The Canadian Institute was a place where every Saturday night in Toronto, there would be a place where one, two, or three lectures would be held. People would be held to a half an hour and they would speak. And he then said we should have a journal of these speeches so that we could more people other than just the audience can hear. So we created the Canadian Journal. The Canadian Institute became the place in all of Canada where anybody with a new idea would go in order to present that idea. It was a place where scientists and engineers and all of the people who were at the forefront of the changes that were happening in Canada would gather to share ideas. The Canadian Journal was published and it went all across Canada and into the United States as people began to respect this. It then was anointed by the monarch and it became the Royal Canadian Institute, and it is now still in existence called the Royal Canadian Institute for Science. I was proud to be invited down to one of their speeches a little while ago. The guy who created AI was there. So they have people like that still coming. And the person who is the chair of the board is a man named Jock Fleming. Fleming, his great-great-grandson, is now the chair of the board. And when I was at Lakefield College School, I taught his children. So I taught Sir Sanford Fleming's great-great-great-great grandchildren. So he did that. Now, let me tell you about the American Revolution. Before the American Revolution began, there was this guy named Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin was the postmaster general. And so he was in charge of the post office for all the British colonies. Not just the 13th, but the 14th in Canada and the 15th over in Nova Scotia. Now, when the revolution happened, of course, Britain said, well, that's the United States, so now we need to have new post office in. So we formed the Canadian post office that was run by Britain. A number of people in Canada then said after a little while, you know what, we could run this more efficiently and cheaply if we ran it ourselves. Britain said, fine, do it yourselves. Now, a postmaster general has been appointed for Canada, the first Canadian postmaster general, and his first job was, now we need a Canadian postage stamp. Well, how should I do that? Should I have put it out on tender? Should I have a contest? No. He had lunch with Fleming and said, could you create Canada's first postage stamp, please? Fleming then did something that no one was expecting. Everybody assumed that he would have a picture of Queen Victoria on Canada's first stamp, but he didn't. He drew, because he's very good at sketching, remember, a beaver sitting on a beaver dam because he liked the symbol of the industriousness, the hard-working beaver. That became known as the three-penny beaver. There was many people who hated it because it didn't have the queen on it, but it was the first time in anywhere on earth that anything other than a politician or a monarch had been on a postage stamp, an animal on a postage stamp. And he was the first one to do it. And what did he do in creating that? He created Canada's national symbol. In 1976, when the Trudeau government... The first Trudeau government, the one without hair, when they decided that they would finally make it official that the beaver was Canada's national symbol, they talked about that stamp and there was pictures of that stamp and they said it was Fleming that did it and now we are acknowledging that that is the stamp. Now, he had done all of that and then what did he do? He celebrated his 24th birthday. So what did you do by the time you were 24? I don't know about you, but that kind of humbles me. This is a busy guy. I'm going to tell you three more things that he did, because for the rest of his life, and he lived to be 87, for the rest of his life, He kept going at that pace. But the name of the book is In Pursuit of Tomorrow. And the reason I called it that, because when I was reading his diaries, in a horrible scroll, his writing is even worse than mine, which is going somewhere, and he was always working on this project, but planning that one, and that one. And that is why I called the book In Pursuit of Tomorrow. Let me tell you about three things, and I'm going to do it really briefly. I'm going to tell you about trains, clocks, and cables. Let me tell you about trains. Remember I said he had a fascination with trains. The train was the technological marvel of its day. What it was going to do is to move people and move goods quicker and more efficiently, cheaper than they had ever been moved in human history. And he was at the forefront of that because now he was a qualified engineer. The people, this business in Toronto, formed a railway company, and they said, we are going to link three lakes. We are going to link Ontario, Simcoe, Huron. So picture that in your mind. And so it was called the Ontario Simcoe Huron Line. And so what we need is a chief engineer to undertake not only the survey to say where should we go, where should the line be, but also someone who can then take charge of building the thing. They hired Fleming to do it. Fleming then set out with indigenous guides and three other guys, and they basically walked from Toronto to Barrie and up to Georgian Bay. Picture doing that. There's no roads. They're walking through woods. They're walking around rocks and lakes and rivers and bogs and swamps. And he is using a sextant and his compass, and he's deciding it should be the road should be here, the railroad should go this way, the gradient should be here, we need a bridge there. He was doing all of that, just basically walking through the woods. He then got to Georgian Bay, and it was his job to decide where on Georgian Bay should this end, where should the terminus be. So we looked all over the place. It had to be flat ground. It had to be good for cultivating. It had to be big enough so it could expand back, a lot of hills up there. And it had to have all of that. Plus, on the bay, it had to be deep enough in order to handle ships that could come in, because this, wherever I pick, is going to grow. This community is going to grow because hopefully the train will stop here. Then steamships will take people north through Georgian Bay and into Lake Huron and out. He finally found the place, and he said, this is the perfect place. And it was a little wee tiny community, just a few houses called Hens and Chickens. Well, he decided if this is going to be the terminus, we need a better name than that. His cohort, the guy that he was surveying with and was actually back in Toronto doing a lot of the office work based on reports that Fleming sent back, his name was Collingwood Schreiber. So we named the place Collingwood. I'm going to tell one little story about Sir Sandford. I say in the book that he got away with a lot of things that he wouldn't get away with now. Before he wrote back and told them where the terminus should be, he purchased a whole bunch of land all around. And then he reported back that's where the terminus should be. What do you think happened to the price of the land? And he then wrote back to his parents and he said, you should come on over. This place is great. And they did. They tried to work in Toronto for a little while. But then where did they resettle? Up in Collingwood. And his dad saw that and he said, you know, this is so beautiful. It reminds me of a place back home called Craigleith. And if you've ever seen Craigleith just by Collingwood, that's why it's called that, because Fleming's dad decided it looked like the place back in Scotland. They created a mill there. They did very well by themselves there. Now, the United States was an enormous threat to Canada at this point because the Civil War is coming. This is the 1850s and the Civil War is coming, and everybody knows that the Americans have always wanted to take Canada. They tried to take us in the Revolution. We said no. They tried to take us in 1812. We fought back. And they know that manifest destiny is such that Americans believe not only should we have everything right to the North Pole, God wants it to happen. Yeah. This is before the big orange man in the big white house. We're talking about the 51st state, all that kind of stuff. And so everybody knew that. Everybody knew the threat that the United States was. And so we knew that we needed more British soldiers here, but we also knew that we needed a way for those British soldiers and our militia units to get around. And so therefore, the Premier of Ontario, which is basically the Premier of Canada, a guy named Sandford MacDonald, no relation to Sir John, and he got together with the Premier of the Prime Minister, the words go back and forth in those days, of Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, and the British government, and they said, yeah, we got to build a railway. And the railway has got to go from St. John, New Brunswick, to Halifax, to Quebec City, Montreal. An intercolonial railway. Who should we get to build it? I wouldn't be telling you the story if it wasn't. Fleming was given the job. What they decided to do was say, Canada would pick one chief engineer, the Maritimes would pick one, and Britain would pick one, and the three of them would work to make sure that the interests of all three were paramount. Ontario, Quebec, and you know what is called Canada even then, said, we want Fleming. The Maritimes said, no, we want Fleming. The British government, the colonial secretary, said there's only one person qualified to do the job. So instead of having three, they had one chief engineer. There he was again, now with indigenous guides and a few others. Now he's walking from Three Rivers, you know, Trois-Rivières, south to Fredericton and south to St. John and then through the woods to Halifax. Where should the line be? Where should the line be? And he decided where it should be. He was then put in charge of building the thing. He was now the chief engineer to put into place all the procurement, all of the stuff, everything that you need, and he started building that railway. Confederation happened in 1867. Now we've got Sir John A. Macdonald. Sir John A. Macdonald recognizes that the American threat is real, and he recognizes the need for something Fleming had talked about in 1858, almost 10 years before. He made a speech at Port Hope. He made another speech at the Canadian Institute. And he said, what we need is a railway going all the way from Ottawa to Victoria. That is the only way we're going to stop the Americans. The Americans are going to sweep north. We know they're going to do it. Do you know on the same day that the British government signed the British North America Act to make Canada, they signed, the Americans signed the Alaska Act, and they bought Alaska from Russia, very same day. Why did Seward, the Secretary of State for the United States, want Alaska? Because we're going to use it to push the British and Canada right out, and we're going to take it over. Everybody knew that. Do you know how they knew that? He said it up front in the American Congress. He said, this is why we want Alaska, because we are going to take Canada. So, Fleming, in 1858, knew all of this stuff. He just foresaw it coming. He knew the American threat was there. So, therefore, he said, not only should we build this railway, here's where it should be. And he drew a map. And he said, not only that, here's what it would cost. He calculated, and I've read the reports. You can actually see the reports online. And I've read the reports where he said, here's how many rails we'll need. Here's how many ties we'll need, you know, the cross ties. Here's how many spikes we will need. Here's how many men we will need to build the thing. It'll take 15 years to build, and it will cost $100 million. $100 million. Mark Carney wishes he could build his for $100 million. But keep this in perspective. The entire federal government's budget in 1867 was $14 million. And now you should build this railway for $100 million. So in 1858, everybody went, yeah, right, son. Yeah, we'll call you. But in 1867, what did they do? They called him. And Sir John appointed him the chief engineer to build the Canadian Pacific Railway. He sent out survey teams, and they came back with reports, but that wasn't good enough for him. He said, I've got to see this place for myself. He grabbed a guy who was the president of Queen's University, Oh, by the way, did I mention that he was the chancellor of Queen's University and was for 30 years? Just by the way. So he knew the president of Queen's University, a guy named Grant. And he got his son, who was only 16 at the time, and a number of indigenous guides, and he basically took the railway from Toronto up to Collingwood that he had created himself, and then a steamship up to Sault Ste. Marie, and then I want you to picture this. Walk, canoe, going horseback from Sault Ste. Marie to the Pacific Ocean. Took him 4 months. Many times he almost died. Grant wrote a thick book called Ocean to Ocean about the experience. There was many indigenous people that he met. Many were kind. Many were not kind at all. And he almost fell off the side of a mountain twice. A couple of his men drowned. It was incredibly dangerous. But he pulled it off. And when he came back, he met with Sir John in the cabin. He said, here's where the railroad should go. And guess where the railroad went? Right there. He was then put in charge of building the thing. Now, a number of things happen, and at one point, he would like to say that he left, but he didn't. He was fired. He was fired for a really interesting reason. But the second thing I'm going to tell you about is the clocks. I told you about the rails, clocks, and cables. Let's talk about clocks. If you go to any town in Ontario, any little town, even big towns, what do you see downtown is the tallest, almost every downtown is the tallest structure. It's the clock tower. Lakefield, Peterborough, many. The clock tower. Do you know why that is? Because every town in North America, in fact, every town in the world, was responsible for setting their own time. What you did is you stood, and when you had no shadow, the sun was right there, and they would set, that's noon. And that would be your clock's time. And everybody just reset their clock. If you rode into town on a horse or a wagon, you would get there and reset your watch to that time. And that was fine. That was just fine. What is going to make it not fine? Because if it's noon here in Lindsay, well, if I went back to my home in Lakefield, it's not quite the same, is it? It's a few minutes off. If you went to Toronto, it's a little bit off again. It's not exactly noon in Lindsay and Peterborough and Toronto. But a horse can never run that fast, that long, so it didn't matter. But a train can. And with trains, it became a real concern that how do we schedule arrival times when every town has its own time? And so every train company created its own time. And therefore, if you were at Union Station in Toronto and there were four different trains that were coming in there that were owned by four different companies, you had to know four different times. In St. Louis, there were 16 different train companies that went through St. Louis, and each had its own time based on where their headquarters was. So the New York train used New York time. The Baltimore train used Baltimore time in St. Louis. And so the people in St. Louis had to know all of those times. It was confusing, it was inefficient, and it was dangerous. There were all kinds of train accidents because people trying to use the same tracks and trying to get across would often crash trains because they didn't have their time set up. Fleming, as a train guy, decided, we've got to change that. I've got a picture in the book of a globe that he created, and he said, what we should do. And I don't even need to explain it to you because everybody knows this. You know, you take the lines of longitude, go around the world, and there's 24, and we say within these two lines, that is this time. And it's 1 hour later this time. 1 hour, and we all know that now. But nobody did then. And everybody hated the idea. The Canadian government, the American government, especially the British government, because they had already established time, standard time in England for their railroads. Every town still had their own town, own time. But they had established, and Greenwich was, this was zero. And therefore, they would say what the time was for all of the trains and all of the ships leaving harbors. Every town could still have its own time. And England said, oh, no, no, if you set that up, then we're going to lose the power of Greenwich. France did the same thing. They had their own time. So did Russia. So did Italy. So did Japan. So did almost every country in the world, where they tried to standardize their times by leaving all the towns to have their own times. And finally they said, no, we are not going to go to Universal Standard Time. Everybody fought against it. He worked for over 15 years. He wrote to heads of states. He visited heads of states. He visited kings and queens and presidents and prime ministers. He visited scientists and railway engineers. He went to presidents of railway companies. He went to conferences in Venice and in Stockholm and in Moscow. He went to conferences all over the place trying to sell this time. Finally, it began to dawn on people that it was necessary. They had a convention in Washington, and in that convention, he was the first speaker, and he spoke and he said, I have these 17 ideas. If this is implemented, it will work. They argued for over 3 months. At the end of it, every one of his 17 was applied. Almost all of the world's countries went to standard time. All of the clocks in all of the world changed their clocks, all because of Fleming. While he was doing that, while he was still running the CPR before he got ingloriously fired, he had made sure that there was telegraph cables all along the railway, because telegraph cables were the way that people were going to communicate through Morse code, through the telegraph cables. He then looked and he saw that this guy named Pinder, this guy in Britain who owned four or five different companies, and it looked like they were all competing, but he owned them all, had laid a cable, a communication cable, that used Morse code to communicate from London all the way to North America. And he said, why not a communication cable that would go from Victoria all the way to the British colonies of Australia and New Zealand? He said, in that way, we could then get another cable going to India and then use the telegraph cables that go by land so that the Brits in London could communicate with all of their colonies around the world. He sold it as a glorious thing for the empire. Everybody hated the idea. It would be too expensive. It wouldn't work. Pinder fought against him. Britain said, we're not putting up the money for it. The Canadian government said, we're not putting up the money for it. He fought for over 15 years, and there was one problem, because outside of Hawaii, there was off their coast about 50 miles, there was a little rock, a volcanic rock called Necker Island, and he said to Britain, you know, nobody owns that. You should get control of that, and then the cable will go to Necker Island and then down to New Zealand. And Britain said, no, we can't do that, because Hawaii is being taken over by the Americans right now. The Americans basically took over Hawaii like they took over Venezuela a little while ago. Hawaii had a queen. They came in, kicked out the queen. They put in this guy named Dole, who they said, I'm the president. You know Dole Pineapples? I'm now the president. So the Americans have been doing this Venezuelan stuff for a long time, and even before Trump. And so what Fleming said is, we've got to move quick. And Britain said, no, we don't want to upset the Americans. So he came up with a scheme. Listen to what he did. He got this ex-admiral, and he said, I want you to take the train to Victoria, take the boat down to Hawaii. I've rented a boat down there. I want you then to take this British flag, go to Neckard Island, and put the flag there. And then we'll say it's British. He got in a little bit of trouble for that, which I talk about in the book. So now, I have told you everything that he did by the time he was 24. I told you how he basically changed how we calculate time, how he built Canada by building the railroads, how he built this cable, because eventually it was built. And he was put in charge of building this cable. He hired the company that did it. He designed where it was going to go, what it was going to be built of, because, you know, the Pacific is different from the Atlantic. And then he said, you know what you should do? You should create a news network, because nobody can trust the newspapers anymore because they're all owned by liberals or conservatives. So therefore, what we should have is in Britain and Canada and New Zealand and Australia, a small network of people who decide what is the unbiased news, what is the news that people really need to hear, and then we should put it on the cable for free. He invented cable news on this cable. And you know what he said it should be called? It should be called fair and unbalanced. Fair and balanced. Who uses that phrase now, fair and balanced? Ironically, Fox News. He came up with the idea of fair and balanced. So, with all that I have said, it was no wonder that when he died in Halifax at the age of 87, news reports went around the world. Everybody knew who Fleming was. Everybody in the world knew who Fleming was. Everybody in Canada knew who Fleming was. Fleming was the most famous Canadian of his day. There's a whole lot I haven't told you about that's in the book. But I think now you understand a little bit more about Fleming and why everybody knew his name on the day that he died. And for that, I thank you.